Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to the Idle Red Hands. I'm Lyle.
I'm Jeremy.
And I'm Alan.
And Jeremy and I are weak.
weak, man.
So even though I promised myself not to buy too many games after the episode on Mutant Chronicles, ended up buying more games.
Really? What did you buy?
Mutant Zero, the original Mutant Chronicles, I suppose, which is a post-apocalyptic game where you play mutants with special powers. I even bought the cards. And I was stupid because I gave the decision to Jeremy. I was like, oh, what do you think? Should I get the cards or not get the cards? And this is the guy that buys the special dice for the game.
We've got all the custom dice, the dark symmetry dice that we need, and location hit dice as well.
So oh, that's good.
Lots of custom 20-sided die.
And I got Bauhaus and the Brotherhood books, as well as White Star. So they're the Russians on Scorched Earth.
Oh, right.
Bauhaus and Brotherhood, they were the role-playing books that I eyed in the 90s when I was like, oh, should I get it? Should I not get it? No, I'll just stick to 40K. But I'd always look at those pictures. And the same, yeah, the cover art's the same.
That's yeah, great. Right. Yeah. Same art. It looks good. Yeah.
Saves them money, but brings me back to the 90s.
Nice.
And you bought...
I bought the collector's version of the core book for Mutant Chronicles.
So jealous.
Yes. And then... And then I discovered Prince August, a retailer in the UK that had the old stock of some of the older Mutant Chronicles board games. So I've got Blood Berets and a couple of decks of Doom Troopers cards on the way. Yeah. So we'll have,
more to say. Yeah. I hope you're fans of Mutant Chronicles.
There's more to come.
I'll just interview you all because I'm the one who doesn't know much about it. So I'll come in here and write a list of questions.
It's because you're too busy watching Clone Wars.
Oh, yeah, man. Clone Wars is a... It's a blast.
We're so topical. We're talking about a game from the 90s. I know it's been re-released. And Clone Wars, is it still around? No, they ended that because Rebels came out, right?
Well, they ended it because of
the sale.
The sale to Disney. And then a lot of the people who worked on Clone Wars are now working on Rebels.
And it looks like the same studio, the same CG.
Yeah, very similar designs. I mean, at first appearance, Rebels does look a little bit more youthful and geared towards children, but I heard otherwise. I heard that the main character eventually really gets conflicted with going to the dark side to the point where he shaves his head and gets really torn.
It looks like the second season, things start to get a little bit more realistic and a little more adult and less every episode is a lesson, for children.
One to grow on. Knowing is half the battle.
But I'm still on season 4 of Clone Wars. I just started. You know what? Despite what I said in our other previous episode, I'm flip-flopping. I really do like the prequels now. And everyone's shunning me for it. I'm like, but the prequels for me, they're more like supplement to the Clone Wars animation,
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, check it out.
It fills in some nice parts of the relationship between Anakin and Obi-Wan that were totally missing from the movies. So yeah, you get to feel a lot more of what was going on between them.
Oh, I should watch that. I do like the prequels. Maybe not Phantom Menace so much.
I like that a lot better than part 2.
Okay, and better than part 3?
Well, I haven't gotten to part 3 yet. Maybe not.
You haven't seen the
third part? I have seen the third one, but it's been a long time.
Oh, okay, Did I ever tell you my idea to make part 3 a little bit better? I know everybody's got, hey, here's here to make the prequels better. But it's just one scene. So it's when Anakin goes into the Jedi training thing with all the kids. Mm-hmm. And they're like, Master Skywalker. And then boom, with his lightsaber. And it was cool. All the kids, all the little lightsabers. He's like, all right, dude. You don't see the fight. But
you have to fight them off.
Even
right?
If it was just the sound.
Yeah, that would be great.
You got your visual. And then it goes to dark. And then all of a sudden you hear
That would have been...
Because they're training to be Jedi. They're not training to be
training to
counselors.
Lay down, yeah.
Exactly. I guess Jedi are kind of counselors, but... I would just say, I'm not going to go on about the prequels, but I find them more memorable than The Force Awakens.
Mm. Oh, yeah. I would agree with
that. Just some of the visuals, like some of the cityscape stuff. Mm. It was pretty striking.
Yeah, and also I'm sitting there looking at this world, and I'm actually enjoying the world a lot more than the Galactic Empire. I'm really enjoying all the political turmoil. I like how there's corrupted officials. I like how good guys can be bad guys and bad guys can be good guys. And I think if I were to role play a game, I would find the Galactic Republic a more interesting setting to role play in just because there's more going on.
Yeah, you were saying that. You were looking for, you were asking us which one of the new Fantasy Flight games would be better to do that.
Right.
And we had a little bit of trouble because Edge of the Empire is, out in the outer rim. Is that what they call it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it just, yeah, it's okay if you kind of wanted to play on Tatooine.
Be a smuggler.
As a water farmer or a moisture farmer. And then Age of Rebellion is good, but yeah, I really enjoyed the West End games, which is kind of like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it pretty much just telling you, here's the game you're going to play as you're fighting against the Empire. Mm-hmm. And there's different things you can do, which you probably couldn't do too much political intrigue when there's no real political environment.
Yeah, so I don't know. I thought that would be kind of cool. And it's kind of sad that something doesn't really exist in that setting.
It will. I mean, the Fantasy Flight, in the X-Wing game, they came out with a ship that I think debuted cinematically in the prequels.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's like one of the clone warrior fighters, I've heard. So they might be doing a little bit more. I wouldn't mind to see some of like Obi-Wan's fighter make an appearance and things like that. So maybe they might release a book on the prequels, but they seem to have like something where they weren't going to do anything with the prequels, it seemed.
Yeah, staying away. Yeah.
They have something that sells better now, you know, the
reselling
sequels.
the reselling of the original trilogy.
But you guys played Arkham Horror just before the podcast. Right. So this is very fresh news.
Yeah. Yes.
And unlike some of our topics, not from the 90s.
Right, yeah. It's early 19th century, early 20th century.
Yeah, but I mean, the release of these games from Fantasy Flight, the Arkham Files, they have a really big world that they've been creating in this setting. Lots of different games in this LCG.
Living card game.
Card game just dropped like last month.
Just dropped. Like it's a hip hop album.
Yeah. It's in the hotness right now, man.
It's hot track.
Right now it's number two on BoardGameGeek because Kingdom Death Monster is like number one or something.
Oh, that's got a new Kickstarter. So yeah, people are freaking out about that again. And the Kickstarter is due delivery in 2020. They're telling you that ahead of time.
Oh, good. Yeah, at least they're honest.
So Tokyo Olympics and your Kingdom Death Monster will be playable at the same time.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
Mm. But yeah, man, you should try it sometime. We can set you up with the deck. And we'll all die together.
Mm. Yeah, because you guys died.
We died.
Oh. We died. Yeah, I went insane. I've been insane previously, but never been torn to pieces.
So just for people who are unfamiliar with Arkham Horror, so it's a living card game, so I think they got the idea that there's cards. So you play investigators, I take it?
Yeah, it's cooperative like the Lord of the Rings card game, but instead of each player having three characters, each player only has one character. And you have like two hand slots, so you can hold one knife and one gun, maybe. You have like a necklace slot and a body slot and stuff like that. And then you can just kind of play other cards as well. And you're going through locations like the hallway and the attic and the cellar. And you have to move from location to location and investigate, get clues to advance the act deck. To win the game, you have to advance the act deck. But there's also a doom track happening on the agenda track. So as that advances, more nasty things come out of the encounter deck.
Right.
And they depict it really well in the game where the agenda and the action are depicted as a book with open pages. And so you're kind of flipping the pages of this book and there's text.
Is it an actual book?
The image is a book, yeah. Oh, okay. So it's two cards. It's just two playing cards.
Oh, but you're flipping
side
the cards.
By side. Right, and you're flipping the cards like the pages of a book. So the story progresses as you're defeating these pages or that they're advancing. Yeah, so it has a really nice connection to the narrative and there's a lot of story and flavor on all of the cards.
Okay.
And it's campaign setting. So what we just did, we died. So therefore, our investigators are now dead and they cannot continue. Right. But we can continue with other investigators. And the stuff that you do in
I like how you clarify what died means.
Yeah.
So they died. So that means they're dead.
Well, like...
No, you can die, but come back with one less health the next scenario.
You're defeated.
Right. But you're dead.
You're not dead. You're just kind of,
Mostly dead.
Yeah, so you can go insane. So you have two stats. You have your mental health and your physical health. And so when one of those is completely depleted, then you fail the scenario, but you come back then with just one less point in there, a trauma, either a physical or mental trauma. So you're a little bit weakened for the next scenario, but you still exist.
Yeah. Gaming, redefining death for 40 years.
The things that you do in one scenario will carry over to the next one, which is kind of cool.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a nice campaign system, and they have, you know, an experience system where you score victory points and can spend those towards experience to buy cards to add to your deck for the next scenario. So it's a little bit of character progression.
I'll have to give it a try. I hope I don't get hooked.
Another game.
I've been pretty good. I've only got one living card game going. It's not really going. Netrunner.
Oh, Netrunner. That's right. Yeah, that's right. It's not really going.
It's postponed.
Postponed. Delayed. Personally delayed. Yeah. Because I've been so busy watching Bob the Builder that I don't have time to play games. Because my son likes Bob the Builder.
Not personally.
Wow.
Yeah, it's people with living machines, the construction vehicle. So similar to Thomas the Tank Engine, for fans of those listening, except it's more balanced where the people actually speak instead of just hide in the trains.
Right.
But I just don't get, they have these machines, but they have like, I mean, I guess they're kind of, you know, for children. So they have the mentality of children, but they give them responsibility on a construction site. It's like, oh, we're going away. Hey, Scoop, why don't you take care of that? So they always have, can we build it? Yeah. And then we go, can we fix it? Because they always have a disaster afterwards. And I was like, oh, we'll work all night. Which I'm like, the cost overruns on this construction crew are insane.
Gotta be crazy.
Yeah. You just think, let's get this Bob guy who is just always a disaster. But it did provide some inspiration for today's episode, thinking about, you know, living machines. So living machines, what can we do with that? And we thought we could do constructs, which is a pretty big topic. So what we decided to do is narrow it down to golems and then talk about things similar to golems, such as homunculi and things like that. Those people unfamiliar with creature features, what we'd like to do is for the first part of the episode, we talk about how the creature is featured in media and legend, and then we'll talk about how to play them as antagonists and then how to play them as protagonists. And I should say, in keeping with a creature feature tradition, we also watched a movie on golems so that we all had at least the common reference point, and that movie was It.
Yes.
The Curse of the Golem.
Starring Roddy McDowall.
Roddy McDowall,
whose name was spelled wrong in the credits.
Yeah. Some selling points of the movie, it was free. It was on YouTube. Roddy McDowall, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
He was in this movie just 1 year prior to Planet of the Apes, if you can believe that. So his star was
on the rise. I can see why they would have cast him as... Who was he? Dr. Zaius? No, he wasn't the
Cornelius.
Doctor. Cornelius, yeah. In Planet of the Apes. And, I mean, we didn't really have a huge library of movies to choose from. I think It is about 10% of all Gollum movies ever made.
Yeah.
And if you take out all the silent films, about 50% of the Gollum movies ever made.
Well, actually, I watched it too, but I didn't make too much sense of it, I guess. It was kind of on in the background. And yeah, it seemed pretty accurate, though, with his depiction of a Gollum.
The research was really accurate, like surprisingly accurate.
Yeah.
Very faithful to the Gollum, including especially the Gollum of Prague, which I think is what they were alluding to.
Yeah, I think so.
They don't necessarily know. I think they say it comes from Eastern Europe, but they don't go, comes from Prague.
Right, yeah. But it took the expert from the New York Museum to get given all the backstory and the legend of the...
I love how, and there's writing on the golem, which we'll talk about a little bit more, but they're always like, is there writing on this? Can you read this? give me your glass. And then he takes the penknife and scrapes it. And I'm like, is that what you do with something priceless? Yeah, we'll see if this is actually, you know 500 years old. And It, do we recommend the movie? No.
We are
going to give you all the information that you need because it was a boring movie.
Yeah, it did make no sense story-wise because the Roddy McDowall character was kind of a poor man's Anthony Perkins.
He definitely came out after Psycho because he has his mother,
right?
Which unlike Psycho, where the big reveal is at the end, you actually walk in and then look at this corpse rocking because you can see the corpse arm,
right?
And he's talking to it, and you're just like, okay, hurry up and reveal that it's a corpse. Because we already know, and he's talking to it and getting her a drink and stuff.
Right, and they reveal that by him. He's stolen a valuable necklace from the museum, and he goes to place it around her neck. So I guess he regularly steals jewelry to adorn his mother's corpse with. And that was the reveal, is him leaning over to put a diamond around her neck.
Yeah. About the jewelry, I thought it was funny when the police later on, when there's these murders, and somebody broke a jewelry case, and they're like, do you think there's anything valuable? What do you think they might have? And he's like, oh, maybe this massive diamond that they didn't steal. And he's like, yeah, it's very valuable. But the police are just like, well, I'm kind of perplexed. Why somebody would smash this jewelry case? Or how about the response time? There's a murder. 12 hours later, police show up. And then they're... who threw that drop cloth over that statue? That was me. Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, maybe don't touch that next time. Next time there's a murder here.
And the ending, the climax, like to jump right to the amazing ending. So he's kind of holed up in this castle that he had brought his mother's corpse, the girl that he loved, and of course the golem with him. And the British army resolves that the only way to defeat this golem after trying various weapons is a small payload nuclear warhead.
Yeah, instead of walking around the golem. Right. Because he's just standing in front of this iron gate. He's pretty slow. And they're like, I'm stumped.
We're gonna
we used the bazooka. We used the cannon. Yeah. Okay, get the... I liked how the nuclear device was on an automatic timer. Yeah, right. It's like, let's stop it. No, it's on an automatic timer. Who does that? It was set hours ago. Yes, like, they wouldn't think, like, maybe something's going to happen in these 3 hours. Think we should have a failsafe? Nah, let it go.
But I'm going to ride my motorcycle toward the bomb to save the girl. And he did it pretty quickly because there's no way he'll make it. It's 4 miles away. He's got 2 minutes. There's no way he'll make it. And he made it all the way back, round trip.
Yeah.
And they were safely behind the barricade. And
so it wasn't a good movie. Mm. But it certainly was accurate. And so some of the stuff that we're going to talk about is in this. And they also gave us some decent ideas of how to use a golem in a game, surprisingly.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so we'll definitely be giving them shout-outs throughout the episode. All right, so what did we learn about golems in our research?
Most of the things that I read talked about the Hebrew tradition of the golem connected to Kabbalah, to Jewish Kabbalah, and that rabbis were responsible or through their investigating in the mystic arts that were kind of given to them by God found this way to create life.
Right. Well, simulate the way almost God creates life.
Right.
Because they make it out of clay, which is what Adam was made out of.
Right. Yeah. Very similar to that. And even some of the words that they used, you know, because the Hebrew word for Adam means earth. You know, it sounds similar to the word that means earth. And so that is a very direct correlation to the creation of life and the creation of man.
Right. And we should say we're going to be using some Hebrew in this episode, and not one of us has been to Hebrew school, so pronunciation might be a little off.
It's going to be rough.
Yeah, so they create it from clay or mud, which is like Adam. And then, like you said, they have a ritual, and part of that ritual involves getting a name of God, not necessarily the name of God, but a name of God, which they call Shem.
Mm-hmm.
And when they get the Shem, they write it down on a piece of paper or something, and then they can put it either in the golem's mouth or in the forehead. And it, the movie we watched, that name, The Curse of the Golem.
Right.
They have it where you have to put it under the tongue of the golem.
Right.
Which was odd, because you make a clay statue.
And you sculpt the tongue.
Yeah. You can put something underneath. So the mouth is always like slightly open.
Yeah. And in the movie, they revealed he must have an esophagus. He was incapable of swallowing. So there's a clay esophagus.
Which we're going to get more into, because that was actually pretty clever, but except when you actually think about it. Some legends, you can write Emet, E-M-E-T, which means truth. And then a way to stop the golem or destroy the golem is to get rid of the E.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just Met, which means death, again, in Hebrew. So I guess the equivalent of an E in the Hebrew script.
I guess if the golem's coming at you, how are you going to stop it? I guess it's going pretty slow. You can just climb up him and just take his mouth. Yeah, just, you know?
I couldn't erase the E. Get the nuclear device. Plan B failed.
Because the base of the creation of the golem was clay or unformed earth, I liked how that was, you know, definitely connected to a dumbness or a helplessness, or it was just a mindless creature that was imbued with life.
Yeah.
So that this magic that creates this life is creating a dumb being, a follower, and then also, in most cases, a silent creature.
Yeah, so the Hebrew golems, they typically can't speak, and they're definitely mindless, with completely obedient until they're not, which is also a common feature when they go on a rampage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because creation is such a big part of the golem story, then destruction, like Alan was saying, is like, you know, how do you stop it? So I think one rabbi Shalom, he said, he's called it like the law of destruction is the reverse of the law of creation. So the way to destroy a golem is just to do the reverse of creating it. So for example, you put the piece of paper with the Shem in the mouth, you just take it out. Mm-hmm. And then in some cases that would cause the golem to disintegrate in the curse of the golem. And probably in stories that you would want to tell, it probably just would stop the golem.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the golem of Prague, I think you took the piece of paper out of the golem's mouth and it would just stop.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that particular case, I don't know if this is common with all golems, it couldn't be active during the Sabbath.
Oh, right.
So Friday evening, because the Jewish Sabbath is Saturday, he would take it out of the golem's mouth on the Friday evening, and I imagine to reinsert it Saturday or Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it couldn't be active during the Sabbath.
In that story, the golem is a protector. So it was, the reason for its creation was actually defensive.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I think all golems, the idea is that they would protect somehow. But definitely, the Golem of Prague was there to protect against pogroms, I think. Yeah, or anti-Semitism of some kind.
Yeah, and I think, but just the golem existing in kind of later popular culture and maybe mm-hmm. later American popular culture, there's a lot of revenge stories. There's a lot of golems created for revenge or, mm-hmm. you know, they live until they've completed some murder or some action on behalf of the creator. So it got changed a bit. I think those original stories, and even in the early silent films, it was based on the Golem of Prague story created by a rabbi. Sometimes the depiction of the rabbi was, you know, like a crazy wizard and kind of a little bit mad scientist like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So kind of disrespectful to that religion, but it definitely was created for defensive reasons, and then things went wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I guess later on, like you said, they would create it for different reasons,
mm-hmm.
maybe just a guard or something, or for revenge. But in, the, I guess, the traditional case, it's presented for a pure reason. And again, the Curse of the Golem does something really good with that, in saying that if you keep getting it to do, keep giving it like selfish commands.
Right. Yeah. Self-serving.
Yeah. Self-serving commands. Then it's going to lose control,
mm-hmm.
which is what happens in the movie. In the Golem of Prague, it loses control. One of the reasons they say is because it fell in love and was rejected. Dungeons and Dragons, their golems, has something interesting where the more damage you do to a golem causes like an elemental spirit that's inside it to start to lose control or to break out a bit. So the golem itself loses control or starts going against the master. So that's a common feature of golems, is like somehow at some point it will lose control, or there's always the potential that it's going to lose control.
And I think that's a story that's repeated a lot, and even in the Frankenstein's monster story, that's a creation turning on its master. So punishment for human audacity, punishment for daring to create.
Yeah, the
life.
Hubris.
Yeah, I had written down here Frankenstein's monster, and like, you know, when we originally talked about this topic, we talked about constructs. So I was really sitting there looking around, trying to think about what else mm-hmm. was like a golem, what would be classified as a construct and what isn't.
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of people think the Frankenstein's monster. I think it's called Adam in the Mary Shelley book.
Yeah, well,
he's called Adam.
The Modern Prometheus is the subtitle, but he refers to himself as your Adam. To the doctor when he can run the monster conference.
So definitely inspired by the legends of the golem,
right.
Or Homoculi.
Yeah.
Homoculus.
Yeah, and even think they refer to that type of monster in D&D as a flesh golem.
Yeah.
It's constructed from dead flesh.
So definitely. That would be, I think, a big difference between the Adam of the Frankenstein story is that it gets a little bit of free will.
Yes.
Or he almost has free will immediately.
And a bride. Oh, that's the sequel.
Doesn't get rejected.
Well, I mean, through a bit of reading, it depends. Like, if you're going by the concept of constructs, not just a golem, they do have different levels of will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they a lot of them just obey their creator's whims, but some are a little bit more literal-minded, and others have complete control over their own will.
Yeah, I think like Homoculi, which is very similar to a golem in the sense that it's created by a master, but it has some degree of free will. It's just like a miniature human or humanoid, and I think common feature might be, at least in Dungeons & Dragons, it shares the senses of the master, but with Homoculi they always have like special powers. Their creation is pretty interesting in that it comes from the sperm.
Right.
So if you capture the sperm and then putrefy it for like 40 days, 40 nights, very biblical.
Right.
I think the womb of a horse is the best place to putrefy.
Yeah, that was the most disgusting detail of that description.
Then there'll be like a little man or woman.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of transparent.
Right.
Transparent. So you need to feed it blood for 40 weeks. Again, womb of the horse, best place to do that. And then it will become like still miniature, but a miniature version, like visible.
Right.
Yeah. And then it gets different powers and that, depending on what story.
Yeah. So that distinction is interesting, because a golem is a mystical creature created by a spell or magic writing and mm-hmm. a magic ritual. And a homunculus is more alchemical. It's more of a process. You know,
the creator beating off the old horse's womb.
Yeah. I call that alchemy.
It's more organic.
Right.
Well, I was thinking like golems seem to have a bit more religious background. And as you said, something like a homunculus has more of a chemical or even magic influence. I guess Gollum also is kind of magic, but...
Well, it's definitely magical. I think when you were mentioning about the distinction between, I guess, the kind of constructs we're talking about in this episode versus the kind of constructs we might talk about in a future episode, such as robots, is that seems to be an element of magic when it comes to golems or homunculi or what you're talking about, Adam. I guess that's the most science fiction-y, the Frankenstein's monster. Whereas robots is very, very technical.
Yeah, but even those robots, like if you think of some of the droids from Star Wars even, you know, they do have that magic power source that really isn't described in too much detail.
I guess so. I guess when you think it's a leap from where we are now, but I suppose, they're treated like machines. So when you create a droid, it's not like you're creating something in your own image. When you create R2-D2, so it lacks that hubris when you create, or at least Star Wars has not played it up where somebody gets punished for creating
C3PO. Anakin was punished.
Yeah, maybe he was punished. That's hubris for creating C3PO. Yeah,
he ordered that kit and was putting that together. And
That's what the real story of the prequels is. See how deep they are.
Yeah. That's part of the ring theory, right?
Yeah. One of the things, though, with I don't know about Gollum, but within general construct creation, they're usually designed with a purpose, and they usually have a thing that they're meant to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that kind of takes over their free will, is this mission, this objective that they're given by their creator. So. Mm.
So because you can really play with that idea of, it's being created for a purpose. Like when you think about the legend of the clay boy, the purpose was to comfort a lonely couple. Like, so they don't have a child, so they make a boy out of clay.
Right.
Somehow it comes to life, eats everything, and them.
Right.
It must be stopped. But, the original purpose was to fill a void in their life of, not having a child. The creation of the gingerbread man was to fill a void in their stomach because they wanted to eat him.
Sounded delicious.
How is he not a sympathetic creature? It seems to be the gingerbread man story is like a lesson of don't brag. He's just running away from people who are trying to eat him.
That's the arrogance of existence, I guess. Yeah.
Because I went back and reread the gingerbread man. I was like, they kind of make him and then he pops out of the oven before they can eat him. And you're like, I suppose you should be the hero, but no.
No, we can't wait for that guy to get eaten.
The arrogance of that gingerbread man. Know your place in life. Maybe that was the lesson of that. Maybe that's the lesson of the construct, is they have a place in life. That actually could be a good story. You brought up the droids. We didn't want to talk about robots too much, but I know a lot of people bring that up. And it says the droids are kind of like the slaves of this world or this galaxy. And nobody talks about it. Nobody cares. They just discard it.
Personalities like that. Yeah, you definitely.
Bye, 3PO. Although he always says, bye, Mom. Oh, you're going to be a slave? Oh, I'm going to care about that next movie. Promise.
I was actually looking for some things in Japanese mythology, and I just have a yokai book. And the things that I came across were things like the Seto Taisho. But there's like a big difference here, We said that the golems are usually created with a purpose, but in the Japanese mythology, the things that I've been finding, they weren't really created with a purpose. They were more so created with negligence, or just they were discarded or disposed of or forgotten about, and that kind of created these constructs to come back and wreak havoc. And it's a little bit different, and that seems to be a bit of a reoccurring theme in a lot of Japanese mythology.
So what is the Seto Taisho?
Seto Taisho, which...
Or Seto Taisho.
Seto Taisho, yeah. It's actually the teapot samurai.
And, oh, okay, well, that's clear.
General Seto, teapot samurai. So basically what he is, he's a collection of discarded dishes and pots and jars. He's got like a sake bottle for a head and pots and pans for arms and stuff like that. And all of them are kind of broken and thrown away, and they just kind of collect and kind of come back.
So is this created by leaving a lot of dirty dishes around, or for eating and drinking too much? Like, what's the kind of the mistake that you made that created this, is just having a lot of pottery trash in your backyard?
Yeah, just getting rid of them and forgetting about them and misusing them and whatnot.
Right,
they're
right.
Kind of discarded items, right. In a sense.
Wow.
What does it do?
Let me look at his attack. He just fiercely charges his opponents, and basically anyone that happens to be within range, he comes and attacks them with his tiny wooden spear.
So you would like wander into a kitchen and be attacked by a teapot?
Yeah, but it's actually, it's a wooden spear, but it has a ceramic jug on it rather than a point, so it's kind of a useless weapon. So I guess he's more of a nuisance, I guess.
The other thing in Japanese popular culture that I found that's similar to the golem is a character in the kaiju monster tradition, Daimajin. And Daimajin, the first movie was in 1966, so around the time of It was released. And it's a giant...
I wonder which was the bigger box office. Yeah, probably that one.
And it's a large stone idol, a Buddhist stone idol, the guardian idols that are up front of Buddhist temples. And it comes to life. It's inhabited by a vengeful spirit and punishes people. So this is all set during the feudal Japanese times. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a monster movie in very, very primitive times. So there's no way to fight it. It's just this unstoppable force, and it wrecks villages and just tears things up. Yeah.
But samurai swords.
Yeah, very swords.
They can cut through anything. Yeah.
But it's interesting that the main difference, because it doesn't have a specific creator. It's created by the spirit world and forces and to punish bad human behavior. So it's kind of nature correcting itself.
Okay.
As opposed to in the Western golem traditions, it's man's arrogance or a specific person that has these divine powers that can create life, but then is punished for that arrogance or that defiance of God.
Yeah.
So it's different. There's more of a Shinto feel, or there isn't that there a direct correlation in Japanese in these Japanese characters to the golem tradition, because they don't have that arrogant person storyline.
It definitely has a different religious background to it, and I think that kind of in a way is very similar to the Teapot Samurai, because it was created by the spirit world, by life.
The most disturbing thing about the Daimajin character is the costume that the actor is wearing has eyes cut out. So you're seeing human eyes coming out of it, showing through a stone, supposedly stone costume. So it's very disturbing.
Couldn't have been worse than the Curse of the Golem costume, which looked...
like a melted candle.
Yeah, like a melted candle, and they had to have actors go, "Oh, that's pretty grotesque and pretty ugly." And
and I love from the very beginning, you were supposed to believe it was stone, and when the original curator touches it, it's just wobbling on the platform. It's obviously rubber with a wooden armature underneath.
Well, just to summarize, what are some common powers that golems have, and what are some common features? So, like, one common feature is that there's some sort of item. And in some cases, when you talk about, for example, a shield guardian or something from D&D, which is similar to a golem, you're talking about an amulet. In the case of a traditional golem, you're talking about a piece of paper or something, a parchment with the word of God, the Shem, written on it.
And as far as their characteristics, they're always described as indestructible. They're very powerful creatures.
As indestructible as clay can be.
Well, yeah.
Which is surprising. Like, even a nuclear bomb couldn't... spoiler. Yeah, the nuclear bomb did not destroy the golem in Curse of the Golem. So it's pretty powerful clay.
Yes.
Yeah, but indestructible, obedient. Like Alan said, there's some sort of purpose generally.
Mm-hmm. They're created, so there is a creator usually. So
there's a creator aspect. Obedient, can't speak, is common among... the Jewish golems, not so much with the Frankenstein's monster.
Right.
The Prometheus. Yeah.
Or even other constructs, because...
Or the mouthy gingerbread man, that guy could speak.
Yeah. That's what made everyone so angry. He just wouldn't shut up.
I guess it depends on your story of homunculus or homunculi.
I don't think there's anything consistent on them speaking or not speaking. I think they can, whatever the story goes. I think in the Golden Voyage of Sinbad, there's a little homunculus, and it can squawk.
See, I only know them from Full Metal Alchemist. I mean, that was a big part of their story.
Oh, yeah.
And they had particularly 8 homunculus.
And they were made through Philosopher's Stone, right?
Yeah, they had pieces of the Philosopher's Stone. But also, the main characters created one. They were trying to bring their mother back to life, so they were kind of trying to create their mother from nothing.
That's kind of an eerie similarity to The Curse of the Golem.
It takes a price, and the one boy lost his entire body, and the other boy lost just his arm and his leg, and then there was this mound of tortured, tormented, twisted flesh, like, just sitting there screaming at them, that kind of had the face of their mother. And then to save his brother, he had to bind his soul to a suit of armor. Yeah, that's kind of the beginning of the story. And then they go out and...
Why didn't they just do that with the mom to begin with? Get a suit of armor, find her soul, bind it to that.
Yeah, but who's going to cut? Who's going to?
You should have been there. You should have been there and told them that. I think that
flaw in your plan.
Well, the thing is, he didn't really know what he was doing at the time. It was kind of a blur, but it worked, and they were able to survive this encounter, this price that they had to pay. But the homunculus were actually based off of the perfect homunculus, and he wanted to be more of a perfect being, and to do so, he decided to create the other homunculi based off of the different sins of humanity. So you had one for each sin that he was casting from his own body.
Right.
And that's the thing that I noticed. The idea of the homunculi is definitely connected to like the psyche or the mental. There's there's always, and even I think in Jung or something, they use that the term homunculus to describe certain mechanisms of psychology. And so there is always some kind of like, you know, something on your shoulder telling you things, or, you know, that it has that connotation.
Yeah. And they have special powers. Just like in Gollum's special powers. One thing, the Gollum of Prague, it could be invisible. Yeah, and he can also summon spirits from the dead.
Wow.
Or it could summon spirits from the dead.
So it did have a bit of its own will, its own consciousness, to be able to do these things on his own.
Well, I imagine that would have to come through the creator. So maybe the creator told him to commune with the spirits of the dead or something like that. Or, you know, make yourself invisible so you can't be seen. Mm. Yeah, in Curse of the Golem, he just goes, wait here for a moment, walks 5 feet, coast is clear, and then as the golem walks slowly.
Sounds the car horn, and the golem jumps in the back. Another thing that was common to the early golem stories was that they were created for labor in some ways. Like their creator used them. In one of the silent films, the creator sends him to go shopping, and he terrifies the store owners by carrying a basket into the store and shopping for vegetables. So there's this servant, you know, the golem is servant to perform physical labor.
And indeed, we just call that high fantasy. Sending your golems out to do your shopping.
But also, they're just known to be really large, you know, even if they weren't just the golems of religious history, you know, even in like MMOs, massive multiplayer online games, like you played WoW, they're in Guild Wars, like they're usually these giant beasts made from the earth, like tied together with ley lines, the power of ley lines and whatnot.
And I even think like something in American pop culture, like Clayface in the Batman comics and Batman animation, I'm mostly thinking of, is a golem-like figure. I mean, it's created by an accident, you know, created by a chemical accident, but he becomes this vengeful, almost invincible foe, this clay created. So this definitely, not a direct connection, but inspiration, I think, inspired by the golem story, is the Clayface monster, because he's always depicted so large and, you know, very indestructible, very, you know, hard to damage, hard to subdue.
Yeah, no, I didn't think of that, but that, I can see parallels or similarities. Yeah. So how would you play them as antagonists, the golem? What are some important things to consider when having a golem antagonist?
I think one of the most important things is having a creator. You know, having someone who created it and for what reasons they created it.
Yeah.
If you just have a golem by itself, that opens up more questions than answers to anything. So.
No, I think that's a good point. I mean, no one cares how a dragon came to be so much. But if you have a golem, yeah, the next question is, where's the creator? If you haven't already encountered the creator. Right. So whether or not the creator is in your story, people are going to have questions. How was it created? Who created it? Why?
I forget, man. You know, you've watched it a lot more than me, but in this movie, It, the Gollum movie, who created that Gollum?
The Rabbi of Prague.
The Rabbi of Prague.
Well, they don't actually... I don't think they specifically say it's that rabbi.
They named Czechoslovakia. Like, they specifically... named the country that it came from that ended up in their warehouse, and they just forgot about it.
They may have even name-checked a rabbi, and I don't remember what they say or who they said. But, I mean, there's a few rabbis associated with the stories of the golem. So I don't know what it is. But, they definitely said, oh, there's a name here. And
yeah, so if it's in your game, the creator being in the game as well is not necessarily as important as just having a creator. Because I can imagine you stumble upon a golem that maybe it was created like hundreds of years ago,
Right. Well, and also, protectors or guardians, like you may stumble into a situation where the creator is dead, but he's left this thing behind to protect, you know, so similar to like a mummy, how it would protect a tomb. So it's a guardian.
I mean, they're indestructible. It doesn't mean their creators are. Mm-hmm. And this we thought was really clever, and it's the esophagus reference, is Roddy McDowall made the golem swallow the parchment with the shem on it.
Right. So he could never be deactivated.
It's eternal. So, I mean, there could be a case that you find out that the column doesn't have a creator anymore, doesn't have a master anymore, because it also could change. I think in the supernatural, the golem was originally created maybe around World War II to fight the Nazis and to fight the Thule Society. But now it has new masters and who it thinks are fine, but they're not Jewish. So you prefer to have Jewish masters. So it can change. So you have your creator. If you don't have a creator, then you got to have a master. And how did that transfer happen?
Right.
So then it also gets into another important aspect of a golem or things like a golem is what's the control mechanism? Is it an amulet? Is it a piece of paper or like a scroll? Or with a homunculus, is it some sort of shared connection, like a telepathic connection that you have?
Yeah, so is there some way to take control of it? And also, what is its vulnerability in general? Like how, if it is nearly invincible, like how can you attack it or how can you damage it? Like maybe there would be special rules or special...
Yeah, absolutely.
Something to give you advantage over it to be able to actually weaken it, to defeat it.
Yeah, well, it gets into what Rabbi Shalom was saying, what the law of destruction is, the reverse of the law of creation. So it's almost like a mystery. Well, we can't really stop it, so we got to figure out how it was created and reverse that.
Right, right.
Well, I know that some things actually try to control the golems through devices. Actually, kind of reading up on golems from like Guild Wars, the Azurans created them, and
the Azurans
are a race in this world. They're little short people,
like gnomes,
and they invent things. They invent a lot of technology, and they invented golems. They originally controlled them with devices. The things they would kind of work on their own, but to be able to give them commands, they actually created like a control panel to issue these commands, and to a point where they made them into sort of a mech of sorts. They're still golems, but they were able to kind of control them from like a compartment.
Okay.
That also kind of reminded me of Evangelion as well, because the beasts that they created are kind of like a giant homunculus. They are kind of, they created a lot of these different
kind of oxymoronic giant homunculus, because homunculus are supposed to be like really tiny.
Well, I mean,
but they are organic. Like, yeah,
they're a created being. I mean, basically, I mean, yeah, the homunculus means like little man, but I mean, the stories have gone on to like a created being of sorts. So they're a construct, but
so like an organic construct,
I guess.
Right. Biological. And there's like but there's also a psychic or a mental connection to the Evangelion, the Avas. Yeah,
the Avas. Yeah, right. Yeah, they're completely.
I think Cthulhu Tech had something similar, where they have the different types of mechs. Some of them are, yeah, they're like that. And I think the inspiration was Evangelion.
Well, as I said, they're these giant flesh beasts that they created over and over again until they could get a perfect one.
Right.
Most of them died and were deformed. And what they inject a pilot into its spine to kind of control it of sorts.
Right.
So to make this neural connection to it. So
yeah, the control is really interesting. How do they take their commands? Is it a verbal command? So the traditional golem would get verbal command, or is it a more of a telepathic connection? So the homunculus, I suppose if you could mentally give it a command or verbally give it a command if you don't speak the same language. Like if you don't speak Hebrew, in the case of a traditional golem, could you do it if you don't speak whatever language they spoke?
Roddy McDowell thought you had to say, "I am your master, walk this way."
So he just always, reminded.
He would always raise his hands and say, "I am your master," and ask him to do
gestures.
Yeah, right, gestures.
Maybe, if you don't know what language, maybe you could try gestures and see. And that, again, that could be an interesting part of playing it as an antagonist. It's also, the unstoppable aspect. I think if you're looking for a way to insert a Jason or a Mike Myers into your game, the unstoppable and relentless killer, then, the golem with a mission. Or the homunculus with a mission, or the giant homunculus with a mission.
The giant homunculus.
Well, I mean, the gingerbread man.
Yeah.
His mission was to be delicious.
Done. I think another thing to consider with the antagonist is that common feature in the stories of they go on a rampage. And what sparked that rampage? And can that be reversed? For example, in Dungeons & Dragons, if it's damaged, maybe you can repair the damage or somehow negotiate to repair the damage. I don't know. Or if it fell in love and was rejected, like the Golem of Prague, could you convince the person that rejected it to maybe feign that they... Oh, no, I really like you, or I love you too.
Right, to regain control.
Yeah, and just to calm it down until you do something else. So, there's certainly a way that you just fight it until there's nothing left. It's zero hit points and you beat it down. But just because it is not unthinking, but simple. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that you have to approach the challenge simply. Mm. Yeah, and think yeah. of different ways in which to go against it.
Yeah. It's motivations versus the ability to control it or kind of yeah. thwart its mission or its programming.
Yeah. And maybe it's just a case of, oh, we got to beat the master or the creator mm-hmm. in order to beat that. We never actually can beat it. We have to avoid it.
Right, right.
And just beat the master, because then that will enable us to beat it. Or if you can take that idea that's common to some of the traditional stories, where it has been created to do good things, to protect people, and now it's on a rampage, so it has that element of tragedy to it. It could be like a fallen paladin, or, you know, the monster that just doesn't understand. So do you want to destroy it, or do you want to save it?
Right. I think that's a very interesting mechanic that you could build into a story is actually redeeming it, is finding mm-hmm. some way to get it back to its original morality.
Yeah.
Yeah, but actually what you said earlier about like confronting its creator or trying to defeat its creator, I don't know if that's necessarily the best way to go, because if it's a rampaging golem, wouldn't it still be rampaging even without his creator? That kind of almost prevents you from being able to stop it in a way.
I didn't necessarily mean that to beat a rampaging golem, you should go after the creator. I just meant defeating a golem. But yeah, you raise a good point. If it is rampaging, then you might actually have to work with the master, who could be a very bad person, to try to figure out a way to stop it. So just think if the British Army had decided to talk to Roddy McDowall instead of vaporizing him with a nuclear blast.
Yeah. If they would have just gone along with the fact that, yeah, your mother's wonderful, and we'd like to see that house that she bought.
Yeah, you take that woman, yeah. She's yours. You just right. get a little yeah. trade. You just give us the golem.
And I love they had to do the B-movie. They had to have the B-movie shot where the golem is carrying the blonde girl in the mm-hmm. negligee. Like, they had to have at least one of those shots where...
I noticed she was in the negligee quite a bit.
Yes. Well, what else did she have to wear after she changed out of her work clothes? It didn't make any sense. And how fast the end of the movie, just the scale of it, just got so out of control. Like, immediately they just, there's reports that he's taken his mother to some place and he's kidnapped this woman from the office and there's a golem with him. Like, everything was instantly escalated for the fantasy.
It gives a little update.
And then the army is there. Yeah, so, and then cuts to the bazooka firing at the golem while it's standing in front of the gates with its arms up.
We've brought all three of our soldiers. Right. And we can't stop it. The bigger challenge with golems is how to play them as protagonists.
Yeah, I think so. Because of just the mindless nature and them being created, you have to have, you know, that their origin would be very difficult to establish. And then your control as a player over your player character would be questionable. Like, you could be controlled, you could be stopped, or how would you be defeated?
Right. One thing I thought, and it gets into the idea that they follow the commands, is you have perhaps a creator that's absent or dead, but they gave you a very open command before they disappeared. So you're spending the time following this open command, and it could be, I don't know, protect the innocent, mm-hmm. something like that. But what it allows you to do is to create a pretty restrictive, but still playable alignment or controls. Or if you play a game like Fate, where they have your catchphrases, it's just one of your big catchphrases. And it's just something that you always need to follow within those parameters. And I was talking to you guys before the episode, and I think, Alan, you said whether or not you would want to share that with the other players is like, you know, I must always protect the innocent, because then they can use that against you. Mm-hmm. Or you just keep that a secret, and, you know, that's fine. I mean, yeah. the last commands could be always protect the innocent, but keep that command a secret.
Like, hidden agendas and whatnot. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe there's more to your commands than you want to reveal. Maybe you have a specific mission, and that's why you're with the group that you're working with, because they are leading you to this mm-hmm. objective.
Help this group and then kill them. Oh, no, I didn't tell you about the second part. Yeah, there was a little... There's two clauses in that command.
Well, I mean, you said leave out the robots or even cyborgs of sorts, but, you know, something like RoboCop pops to mind, mm-hmm. where he has his directives.
Yep.
But he's still he could still be a very playable golem of sorts.
Or could be a playable RoboCop.
Right? A robot. Yeah. it is a golem, but it's definitely a way to think about how to play one in a game. So,
you know, you mentioning that makes me think you have a fantasy town, and instead of like, or even like a weird science fiction town, but instead of creating like RoboCops or things like that, they create like a golem police force. Mm-hmm. So you still get the same ideas like you would in a movie like Chappie or RoboCop or iRobot, but you have a more mystical bent to it. Yeah.
Well, those are like the Bioroids from Netrunner, which we happen to read a book called Golem based off the Bioroids from Netrunner.
Yeah, Bioroids from Netrunner are androids?
They're androids, yeah.
But you were saying, Alan, that there was a derogatory term in the story itself for to insult, you know, these are just mindless creatures with directives, seeing that you don't have your own identity, your own free will. So that was the insult.
Now, we're assuming you're playing these as protagonists to play them as good characters. So, of course, you can go on the rampage and then be bad. And now I have sort of free will. But you could also have it where a golem or something like a golem is created by a bad master or a bad creator. And the rampage is actually to do good things. I mean, you could work with it if your game master is willing to work with that regard. I would prefer the kind of final command approach, but certainly that's one way to do it. It reminds me of, or another way to do it, and I don't take any credit for this, but I wish I could give the proper credit, because I read this story online, and it was an ogre who finds an intelligent sword, a good intelligent sword, which and the sword is smarter than the ogre, of course, and it makes it do good deeds. Eventually, the ogre kind of becomes good through that. It was actually a very touching story.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
I think I may have put it on our Facebook page, but a long time ago. But you could incorporate elements like that. So the golem is mindless, but it could be given something like a magical amulet that's intelligent, or a sword, or something that's intelligent, and it's controlling the golem. Yeah. Or getting into what Alan's saying, you have like a little, you can have a homunculus controlling a golem. Climbs into the little.
We have like head. This symbiotic relationship there. Yeah. So, but both have to have their own life force, I guess. You know, otherwise the golem would just be a vehicle for it.
No, it's definitely a cheat in that respect. But it could be one way to do it, in that you're really just an intelligent sword or something, but you have a golem body. Mm-hmm. And then what happens if you lose that body? Like,
Or what if you just have to find another body, I guess?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What if you're the ogre that loses the sword?
Mm-hmm.
And then are you going to become a rampaging, violent ogre again?
In the story, no. But yeah, certainly, that is something.
I think as a protagonist, you're much more tempted to play the creator and to make the creator so weak or so physically unable to do anything that he needs the strength of his creation. He needs the strength of the golem, so that the player is playing the actions of the golem, but it's the origin was the creator itself. So you would just kind of like, you know, take the creator out of it, or just have him trailing behind, or maybe riding on his shoulders like Master Blaster. So the creator would be present, but the actual actions and everything that of that character, you know, would be the golem. Mm-hmm.
You bring up a good point. I mean, you don't actually. Do you have to actually be the golem, or can you just have like a golem minion? We talked about them as being antagonists, but...
Well, I think the challenge was to be the golem. Mm-hmm. Jeremy's done the end run to be the creator. But yeah, I think it would be more challenging to be a golem or something like that. And you think about it, if you were a flesh golem or something like Adam from Frankenstein, then yeah, there is some free will, but there's also certainly a big motivation or an independent motivation. It's like, what am I? You know, am I man?
And I think to give that story to that character of seeking your creator and finding your origin, finding your father, finding your creator.
That's good. Yeah,
would make that a much more compelling character to play as a protagonist.
And I mean, you're talking about a world of magic. You've been created by magic. There's nothing to say that there couldn't have been lightning hits you and it suddenly gives you like a little spark of independence. And now, I mean, after a millennium of just standing there in front of this doorway, guarding it, you're like, oh, I want to find who created me. Why they created me? Was it just to stand in front of this doorway? Mm. And that can become a pretty compelling story. And then you would hook up with adventurers or whatever, or it could be in science fiction, you hook up with like people that land on your planet and then you travel with them, because that's better than just staying there.
Yeah.
It's very much like Johnny Five, man, from Short Circuit.
I was thinking about Johnny Five in Short Circuit, and then also I was thinking about Rey in The Force Awakens, where she wants to stay on that planet, even though, hey, they haven't come back, so you might as well just go somewhere else.
Well, one of the things that came up just in the recommended films when I was watching all the silent golem films was Fritz Lang's Metropolis, that they kept bringing that up. And so that scene, that creation of the Maria robot, is very interesting, very compelling. It's a great creation scene, and that's kind of foreshadows the Frankenstein, you know, kind of laboratory creation scene. So I thought that was very compelling. I forgot how good that movie is. Like, as far as silent films, that's just like, it's amazing.
I guess if you wanted to go to the soulbound route, you could have your soul bound to like a mechanical or suit of armor or some kind of golem of sorts. So you have a lot more free will and whatnot, but if you really wanted to go that route.
You can make it so that if you wanted to create one of these constructs, you have to take like a soul bounded to it. But what about these souls? That do they have any say in the matter?
Well,
are they going to like being bound to this?
Usually not. I mean, that's kind of what I heard, is that the body, the vessel, is a bit like a prison for the soul, and they can't really leave from it. It's like they're trapped there. I don't know, and that's probably why they're so hard to control for the most part. Mm-hmm. But
oh, that makes sense. And then once they break free, what are they going to do?
Enjoy the afterlife.
Yeah. Or trying to enjoy life in the suit of armor. It's like, this is not the life I would have chosen, but I am alive, so to speak. In a sense, it's like the dreadnoughts in 40K, or even the Wrath Lords, where they take a spirit stone and then they put it to these big constructs, and now they control these monsters. And the dreadnoughts, they're stuck inside these dreadnoughts, and what do they do when they're not fighting? And are they satisfied with that?
Right, right. That's an interesting idea. And the idea of the golem that came up in the original thinking, the original Jewish tradition, is it's an unfinished being in God's eyes. It's an incomplete being. So playing that as a protagonist, it's almost like a Pinocchio story. I was created. How do I become real? How do I become how do I legitimize myself? How do I gain intelligence? How do I gain something that I don't have? Because I'm not done. I'm not perfect. I'm incomplete.
Sure. Yeah. No. Yeah. It's a good point. I mean, Alan was talking before the episode about clones. Want to know, are they complete? Mm-hmm. Because they're a copy. No, definitely. And that can be very frustrating. Like in Pinocchio, I mean, if I swap out parts, can I become more of a more of a man, more of a woman?
Yeah, I mean, that was actually touched upon in Blade Runner, for example. All the replicants wanted to have more life, to be something other than just a slave of sorts. So. Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't give it to them, they push in your eyes.
Well, that was Adam destroying his
creator. Lesson number one about being human.
Right. Yeah,
don't push my eyes in.
Which they edited back in. I guess it was that crucial to the storyline.
All right, well, that ends our episode on Creature Feature Golems. We're certainly going to want to revisit this, focusing more on the technological side, the robots. Alan's certainly given you enough sneak peeks into what we're going to be talking about.
We've got the release of Ghost in the Shell coming up, so...
Definitely, I have the manga for that, so I have to reread that.
Yes. Oh, and I've got the video if you want to borrow that. You should see the theatrical film that the live action...
Mamoroshi one?
Yeah, will be based on, yeah.
Okay. Well, I have my homework.
She's not really a robot, though.
No.
All
right.
Bye.
Anyway, thank you very much for listening. Take care.
Bye.
Drive-Thru RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-Thru RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.